Hello, welcome to the House of Comments. This is a podcast about politics. I'm Mark Thompson, and we've been taking a little break for the last couple of months since the general election. Frankly, I needed a break, and I'll continue to take a break probably over the next couple of months. But I wanted to do a special one-off during this hiatus just to cover the budget. I'm delighted to be joined tonight by Raphael Burr of The Guardian. Hi, Raphael.
Hi there.
How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good. Thanks for coming on.
That's a pleasure. It's been a while. It's been probably a couple of years, actually, I think, since we did this.
Yes, yeah. And I used to have a co-host, but I just do them on my own now. Yeah. So, but this is a special episode where we're just going to talk about the budget. So okay. Instead of there being two or three topics, as there normally are. So I actually did want to wait a few days until after the budget, because we used to see this with the budgets under New Labour as well, in that what the instant reaction was then not reflective of the reaction 4 or 5 days later after we'd had time for everything to sink
that's
in
true.
Although
the funny thing is, there is, we have sort of got into, we've established a pattern around George Osborne's budgets where you now do know that there will be an instant reaction that will, you know, apart from that awful one, that the Omni shambles budget. But since then, when he sort of politically got his act together, you always know that there will be something where everyone will be saying, goodness me, this is extraordinary, ingenious. He's sort of massacred a bunch of Labour foxes. He's advanced his tanks onto, you know, different bits of lawn everywhere. And that will last about 24 hours. And then you'll get to the follow up phase where everyone goes, well, actually, it's all a bit smoke and mirrors. It doesn't really quite achieve what it's meant to achieve, doesn't really stack up the way he's been saying. And then the left get very angry and self-righteous about that, feel very betrayed that everyone's been celebrating the budget as a stroke of genius. And then no one else cares, and the political benefit goes to the Chancellor. And that was exactly the pattern that we've just seen over the last 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing that seems to have kind of been shaken out of the tree in the last few days is that the initial apparent stroke of genius of having a living wage, I'm going to put living wage in quotes because it isn't really a living wage, but of £9 an hour by 2020, and that's supposedly making it more palatable for the tax credit cuts that are coming in. Really, those figures don't stack up at all, and the people who are going to lose out from the reduction in tax credits are going to lose out absolutely massively. And
that's absolutely right, and they don't, the numbers don't add up. There is clearly, and you know, and it was sort of felt obvious almost immediately, but certainly when the IFS and Resolution Foundation and others crunched the numbers, it was obvious that that there was no realistic compensation there. But I'd be wary of saying that very substantially undermines the political point that the Chancellor was making, because I think, to be blunt about it, I don't think he cares about that side of it, because I think actually, you know, what we're learning about George Osborne's political strategy is he doesn't really need, you know, all the people who lose out from these measures to vote for him. A lot of them won't. Some of them might, but a lot of them will just be cross. He doesn't need the people who are made the most sort of angry and self-righteous and morally affronted for good reason in many ways about that to vote for him. What he needs is for a lot of other people who aren't affected by it to feel that the story he's telling is plausible. And here the story is the shift from a low wage, high welfare economy, as you put it, to high wage, low welfare economy. And because that is actually, probably broadly speaking, a sensible kind of transition for the economy to undergo. There's a lot of, you know, middle, you know, people in the political centre, a lot of Blairites and soft Blairites in the Labour Party would think is something that needs doing. It's something that Ed Miliband said needed doing. His sort of political victory on that point, I think, is actually secure, even if, as you say, the numbers just don't add up.
So do you think Labour are now facing a situation in this parliament similar to the one they faced in the last parliament, which is that the Tories in the first few months of the parliament started in 2010 were able to set this narrative almost in stone that Labour crashed the car and it was, you know, Labour that caused the problems with the economy and that you can't trust them with the keys again. And then that it was actually whilst Labour were in the middle of trying to elect the leader. And we've got a similar thing here where you've got Harriet Harman desperately trying to react to this whilst three of the four leadership candidate contenders are contradicting what she's saying, or at least are reported as not being happy with it. And in the meantime, George Osborne is able to set another very simple messaging train, the message that you just elaborated.
Yeah, I think it is very dangerous for Labour for precisely that reason. And actually, in some ways, you know, I'm at the moment, I'm in a phase of being very pessimistic about the Labour Party. So I apologise to listeners who find this all very depressing and dismal. But it almost feels worse than in 2010. In 2010, there was quite a lot of energy around still after the financial crisis. I remember going to all sorts of meetings and the seminars, and all the think tanks were alive with the discussion of how do you do a different kind of statecraft in the face of the financial crisis? What does it all mean? It felt like there was actually quite a fertile discussion about Labour's future. Now, 5 years on from that, and how much of this you just sort of blame on the sort of Miliband mulch, the fact that he didn't really clarify the position over those 5 years, I don't know. But now I don't sense that there is that same level of discussion. I sense that the Labour conversation has ossified and polarised, and either you just say there's a sort of a left that says we fight back against the, you know, evil Osborne austerity narrative, and there's a sort of, you know, a Blairite right, crudely speaking, that says, look, grow up, listen to the electorate, just go along with this stuff because it's popular. And there isn't a very sophisticated articulation of any middle ground, which would be there must be a moderate centre-left progressive way of dealing with the budget deficit and the fiscal challenge. And what you sense, what I get the impression from what George Osborne at the moment seems to be quite effectively doing, is forcing Labour back into its sort of comfort zone of perpetual opposition, and saying, you know, that he's entirely relaxed if the division of Labour, no pun intended, sort of division of duties in British politics, is the Labour Party stands just on the outside, heckling and shouting and complaining, wringing its hand, beating its breast, being very conscientious and moral, which is a good thing for the Labour Party to be. And the country says, yes, that's absolutely good and right. That's exactly the sort of thing we expect the Labour Party to do. But that's not governing. And we have the Tories to govern, and we have Labour to complain about government. And you can settle into that equilibrium, as we learned in the 1980s, for a long time. And I think what Harriet Harman was doing, in fact, I'm pretty confident from speaking to people, what Harriet Harman was doing on Sunday was essentially slapping Labour in the face and saying, we cannot settle into that equilibrium.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite depressing. In fact, I'd go so far as to say your description of the position of the Labour Party could seem to quite a lot of people on the left profoundly depressing, because it almost feels like it might be worse than the 1980s. At least when I was only very young in the 1980s, but I do seem to remember there was a fair bit of fight in the Labour Party. It seemed Neil Kinnock was actually fighting a lot of people internally, but it felt like he was really trying, and that there was some attempt at a narrative and an attempt at battling against what Thatcher was doing. And of course, the vote on the left was split between Labour and the SDP as well. Whereas what you've got with UKIP is you would sort of have hoped, or at least people on the left would have hoped, that might have split the vote on the right. But actually, it sort of had the opposite effect. And also, this is a slight digression from what you just said, but I can't help but feel that there's something missing from this discussion, and that is that there aren't that many big beasts on the Labour benches. And I wonder if one of the effects of the TBGBs over the years, and especially Gordon Brown and the kind of iron fist that he used internally within the Labour Party, sidelined some of the big beasts who might now be senior shadow cabinet members. I'm thinking of people like John Reid, Alan Milburn. They're just not around anymore. People like that aren't around.
No, that's definitely something that people who in the sort of mid to late noughties were saying, for goodness sake, don't let Gordon Brown become prime minister, that would be a disaster, are now saying retrospectively. And there is a lot of truth in that. It's very hard to know how. I agree. I mean, you do look at the Labour front bench and you think, where are all the kind of substantial big beasts? But there's a sort of a chicken and egg thing there, isn't it? When someone gets a ministerial job and they've been in the front line for a bit, they grow quite a lot in stature. I mean, George Osborne is now almost without doubt the most substantial and impressive in a sort of amoral sense of the word. It's a political calculation figure in Westminster. But in 2000 and in sort of 2008, 2009, the charge was that he was a sort of neophyte, inexperienced. I mean, he himself advised David Cameron to bring Ken Clark in, do you remember, as shadow biz secretary, say we need someone to give us a bit of bottom, a bit of seriousness and credibility.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously they do look a bit like political pygmies sometimes, but I think that's partly because, as you say, that there's no message and no fight. I think the going back to that point about the sort of early and mid 80s, I was also, you know, too young to really be following it closely. I mean, I remember it. In a sense, it was obviously worse for Labour then, because it was split and you know, literally in the SDP formed, and the sort of militant entryism was very aggressive, sometimes physically aggressive. I mean, it was a lot more febrile in that sense. Although, I mean, in terms of Jeremy Corbyn sort of surging in the Labour leadership contest, there is a sort of intellectual ideological entryism going on there, which could be very damaging, I think, for the Labour Party. But the comparison, I think the most useful historical comparison that I've alighted on, because people say, is it like 92? Yes, it is a bit like that in terms of the mood and what happened with the opinion polls. Is it a bit like the mid-80s? Yes, because Labour was sort of out and the Tories were triumphant. But actually, I find the most useful comparator is it's the sort of the flip reverse image of where the Tories were in about 1999, 2000, 2001, where it sort of didn't really matter what they said, and they might be right about things. And when they, you know, so William Hague actually turns out pretty right about the European single currency, but culturally they were so marginal, and this sense that they were just not the main show in town. They were, you know, I was describing it the other day as, you know, like when you visit the political zoo and you want to go and see the big beasts, the lions and the tigers and the elephants and the big things, and you walk past the kind of the tapirs and you think, oh, well, that's an interesting looking animal. What's that? You know, that's the Labour Party. And it's quite curious. Looks a bit funny. It's not what you came here to see. And that's the danger now, it seems to me, more than sort of ideological schism or civil war, is Labour just becoming the kind of the tapirs of the British, of Westminster political firmament. The SNP, you've seen tonight, choosing to vote on fox hunting, which triggers all sorts of interesting constitutional questions about, you know, why they're voting on something that only affects England and Wales legal settlement. That puts the Tories in, you know, in Cameron in the position of possibly losing a vote. All these dynamics are going on, and the Labour Party just every step of the way seems to be drifting into a sort of a marginality in politics.
Yeah, so the Labour Party are tapirs, the Lib Dems are cockroaches. what do you think the Labour Party can and should do then from where they are at the moment? Because I appreciate the parallel that you're drawing with the period of the late 90s, early 2000s, which is a period I remember much more clearly than the 80s. And I remember feeling very, very sorry for William Hague, because despite the fact that I wasn't a Tory supporter back then, I did feel that he was a good man who actually came across very well and did seem to have some interesting things to say. And I remember seeing the interview with him during the 2001 general election campaign that Paxman did with all three of the main party leaders. And I thought he did very, very well in that. And I remember turning to a friend of mine I was watching it with, who wasn't very political at all. And he said, oh, he's really good. And I said, yeah, he is. He's not going to win, though. He's going to get absolutely thrashed. And of course, that was exactly what happened. From where Labour are at the moment, do you think they've even got a chance of being the largest party in 2020? I appreciate that, so that's a long way away.
It is a long way away. I mean, there's a couple of things to say about that. I mean, the sort of the opposite account to the one I've just given is that Ed Miliband really was a very disastrous leader for the Labour Party. And I think part of the problem wasn't necessarily, I mean, also the problem was the positioning and the policy, but a bigger problem was that no one knew what the positioning and the policy were. So it was such a sort of broad, blanket, sort of visceral aversion to the idea of making Ed Prime Minister, just generally sensing that Labour weren't ready, that you've got to think that someone, sort of anyone who can just muster some kind of conviction and radiate some kind of confidence about what they're doing, when you'll have reached a stage where the Tories will have been in for 10 years, probably had a civil war over Europe, and implemented really some very brutal, unpleasant things that at some stage you think there will be some public recoil from. Actually, it should be possible for a half-competent Labour leader who just seems more credible than Ed to get within striking distance. If you factor into that the fact that Scotland, even whether it's the SNP or Labour, doesn't matter. They are not going to vote. They're not going to back the Tories. So a sort of a Labour proposition that can somehow decontaminate the idea of governing with the SNP there in the background, which we know was a very problematic proposition for them in the last election. But that's something that could sort of change over the next few years. It's not impossible to imagine a situation where, you don't need that big a swing away from the Tories to get to a position where, you know, the position that Ed thought he would be in, that the most likely candidate to be prime minister is the Labour leader. And this time it's someone that people actually can imagine being prime minister a lot more than they can imagine Ed as prime minister. So, yes, that could happen. But just a final point on this. I mean, I was, as I happened, talking to someone who was sort of quite closely involved with Ed's campaign just earlier today, who puts it very well, I thought, said, you know, the reality is all the stuff that they were saying to us, the journalists, about, you know, this is, you know, about the election we've just had, you know, this is actually quite a difficult election for us to lose. You know, it's actually very hard for the Tories. It was true. It was a difficult election for them to lose. They just managed really well to lose it. You know, they really strained every sinew to be bad enough to lose what was actually a very easy election to win. So they could do that again. But it does also mean that kind of opportunity, you know, Tories not massively loved, a bit of competence. You know, it's not all doom and gloom, but I think the best case scenario is still going back to that sort of Tories in the early noughties sort of analogy. When you look at the candidates they've got, and you park Jeremy Corbyn for a moment, which is a very different proposition, sort of any of the other three probably, I think, represents the sort of Michael Howard phase where the public probably look across, especially if it's Yvette or Andy, looks across and goes, well, haven't you just been around forever? And weren't you still part of that whole thing that we rejected? But at least it gives a bit of space for them to get their act together, move a little bit closer to the finish line. And then the sort of best case scenario you're looking at really is something a bit like Cameron's result in 2010, where it's indecisive, but the opposition get a go.
Yeah. I mean, it is also worth bearing in mind that Cameron only has a majority of 12. I mean, you know, yeah. And all the plaudits. And I mean, I wrote a very, very long piece not long after the election where I tried to kind of, it was almost a stream of consciousness for what was the most remarkable night of politics in my lifetime. And I did a podcast the week after as well. And, it was remarkable, but he has only got a very, very small majority. The fact that you've just mentioned, as I had just read before we started recording, that the SNP are now going to vote on fox hunting. And that could now mean that Cameron loses that vote in the Commons. Well, you know, if he had a solid majority like Labour had even in 2005, that probably wouldn't be an issue. So it's not going to take much for that to be whittled away over the course of the next
year. No, it's not. And also,
everything to be knife-edged like it was in the middle of the 90s for John Major.
And remember, Cameron's said he's not standing in 2020, so they've got to somehow effect a transition to a different leader, and they've got to deal with this Europe thing. But again, switching back, you know, I'm sort of veering between optimistic and pessimistic accounts. I mean, I'm increasingly sort of concerned on Labour's behalf, as it were, because I try to be nonpartisan about these things, or not very successfully, but that the Europe thing could end up damaging Labour almost as much as it damages the Tories. I mean, you get a sense already, very strong feeling bubbling up from the left, looking at what's happened in Greece, that the EU has become sort of handmaiden for wicked austerity. A lot of the accounts of the way arrogant European institutions, open brackets, the Germans, close brackets, are trampling over the sovereignty of plucky, heroic Greece, is feeding this new Euroscepticism of the left. Now, you add into that the possibility that Cameron gets some concession on labour rights, on agency workers' rights or working time, and it becomes very easy for the left and the union movement to find themselves saying, well, why are we suddenly wasting our political capital, you know, going even anywhere near platforms in support of David Cameron? You know, isn't it sort of easier, more comforting and in keeping with our principles to say this has become a neoliberal pro-austerity, bad EU, Cameron's EU, we're not for it anymore. And then you'd have a massive split between that argument and essentially the EU, yes, at any costs, Blair right wing of the Labour Party. So it could be as, it could almost be as monstrously damaging for Labour unity as it almost certainly will be for Tory unity.
Very interesting, because that you could start to find that things go back to the way they were again 30, 40 years ago when Labour was, or large parts of the Labour Party anyway, were against the EU and closer integration, which certainly hasn't been the case in recent years. Just before we wrap up, just want to, because we've slightly moved off, which is
great.
That's fine, because that's one of the things I really like about doing this podcast, because I just tend to follow wherever the discussion goes. And it's been a fascinating discussion about the various consequences, specifically for the Labour Party largely, which is sort of what I wanted to talk to you about. But just in terms of the budget itself, I mean, what do you think it will be remembered for? Do you think it's as epoch-making as it seemed, you know, 5 minutes after George Osborne had sat down? Do you think it will stand the test of time and it will be looked back upon like some of the major budgets of the past, like Geoffrey Howe's budget in the early 80s and Nigel Lawson's in 1988?
It's a hard question to answer, obviously, because it's a hostage to fortune. You just don't know. My instinct is actually, yes, it will be, but it will, because it's George Osborne, it will be remembered as an enormously political budget. So if, you know, significant because of the politics of it. I don't think it will refashion the economy. I mean, think about those, you know, the Lawson budgets and the Howe budgets. They were so significant in terms of, you know, yanking the sort of the steering wheel of government and saying, now we're going in this direction. I don't feel it really did that, because the overarching narrative is still fiscal discipline on a trajectory that we calibrate a little bit in terms of what politically we can get away with. I mean, the great irony of the situation is that having essentially done half the deficit in the Parliament 2010 to 2015, and now 2015 to 2020, George Osborne saying that he's going to just about make it to surplus at the end if he can. In other words, getting into surplus as soon as possible within this Parliament. What George Osborne has actually done is implemented Alistair Darling's fiscal consolidation trajectory, followed by Ed Balls's fiscal consolidation trajectory, and called it George Osborne's plan. And the fact that Labour has sort of allowed him to get away with that is one of the most monstrous failings of left politics that I can remember, because it's extraordinary that that's what he has actually done. So in that sense, it doesn't feel like a big different direction. I do think that his national minimum wage, living wage, you know, call it what you like, it will be remembered as politically significant. First of all, because it is a Conservative Chancellor just sort of by fiat saying, we order everyone to have higher wages. And you can argue about what's not high enough and it's not adequately compensated for, because it doesn't adequately compensate for the loss of tax credits. Nonetheless, you know, he has sort of blown the low pay commission out of the water. He's just made this big statement, and also even the branding of it. I mean, the left are sort of complaining, and with some justification, about the fact that he's called it a living wage and it's not really a living wage. Well, nonetheless, he is conceding the point that a minimum wage should actually be something that you ought to be able to live on. And once that is a genie that is out of the bottle, and this is a genie that, you know, that Ed Miliband spent 5 years saying we really ought to let this out of the bottle. And if the Labour Party doesn't have wit enough to claim some credit for that and get into the politics of saying, you know, there is more rejoicing in heaven when a sinner repents and all that, then they're missing a trick. And if they lurch into saying, well, it's not good enough, it's useless, it's just a Tory con, and we'll just go into a corner and nurture our fantasies of a very different living wage, which would be our pure Labour living wage, and sort you, George Osborne, and your evil Tory living wage, they will be making themselves more marginal to politics. So that's a long answer. The short answer is, it looked big because politically it was big. In terms of macroeconomic, you know, changing the shape of the country, it was sort of medium to small size, I think.
That's a very interesting point you make about Labour's response to budget could be, like you say, to embrace what George Osborne has done and then use that as a platform to say, of course, ideally, we would go further. And because George Osborne is the one who's changed the terms of trade and has accepted implicitly, explicitly, that we need a living wage now, that actually, with the right leader and the right way of responding to that, could actually massively play into Labour's hands. However, you veered between optimism and pessimism during the course of this podcast. I have to say, I am not optimistic that Labour will take that opportunity. I fear that they will drop the ball on that.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a massive opportunity for Labour. But there was an equivalent opportunity in 2011, 2012, when the Chancellor completely abandoned his original fiscal targets and let the automatic stabilisers kick in and essentially let welfare spending go up and just said, well, we'll have to deal with this deficit at a much slower rate. Now, that was the opportunity for Ed Balls and Ed Miliband to say, oh, I see. So what you're actually doing is plan B, like we've sort of always said you should do, because you were going too far too fast and it wasn't working. So welcome over to the sort of side of the sensible. But what you've done is sort of plan B minus. You've got a half-assed plan and you're going to get half-assed recovery, and then Labour would have been in a position in 2015 to say, well, yeah, they did what we saw, they did half of what we said they should do, they got half a recovery. Think what a great recovery they would have been, they'd be, if they'd actually listened to us a little bit more. I'm not saying that would definitely work, but it would definitely have been a much better position. It would have been a much better position than the one Labour was actually in. So Labour spent the last parliament building up George Osborne's credentials as this man who was absolutely committed to fiscal discipline while Labour wasn't, doing the sort of the branding of Osborne as the sort of hard man, competent Chancellor for him. Now, the danger of doing exactly that all over again, it seems to me, quite high. Whereas, you know, to cut a long story short, I just think Labour, that they have got to find some way of, to master the art of damning with faint praise and then using that as a device to claim back some political territory. What they cannot do is every time George Osborne, even in a cynical sort of Potemkin village kind of way, moves onto what he calls the centre ground, if Labour gets into the business saying, well, you're calling that the centre ground, so we better go off a little bit further to the left, well, you know, we've been in that movie before.
Indeed. And we know how that movie ends, unfortunately. OK, it's been great to have you back on again, Raphael. Thank you very much.
Thanks. I don't need much incentive wibble on about politics, as you know.
No, same here. It's always been a weakness of mine.
Thanks very much.
So it just remains for me to thank Audio Boom, who very kindly host the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music.